Hello and welcome to the latest edition of The Office Block with me, Paul Dillon. We've reached our 10th show and a big thank you to all our listeners who have taken part and supported us. As always, if you wish to continue the conversation, please do so. You can find us on Facebook at The Office Block or over on Twitter at The OB Tweets. Now for today's show, we're talking about a subject which is ever topical and indeed ever on our minds. We're talking about pay and salaries in 2019. And who better to discuss all this with than Professor Bill Roach of UCD and Dr. Valentina Palucci, also of UCD. You're very welcome on the show.
Thanks very much.
Bill, can I come to you first? I think it would be fair to say that there's no one more expert than you on pay trends, pay bargaining than you in Ireland. Would you be able to give an overview of what has happened in relation to pay and salaries since the collapse of social partnership in 2009?
Yes, Paul. With the collapse of social partnership in 2009, we entered a period roughly going up to 2011 when collective bargaining was dominated by something that commentators like us call concession bargaining. That is, it was typically employers who made demands on unions for the deferral of pay rises, for pay freezes, even for pay cuts and changes in working practices, with a view to ameliorating job losses or better protecting jobs. And that was the dominant pattern pretty well up to about 2011. From 2011 up to roughly maybe about 2016, a new type of pay bargaining developed in Ireland that is called pattern bargaining. This arose quite simply when SIPTU targeted export-oriented, commercially successful firms in the biopharma sector and healthcare devices, essentially to kickstart bargaining over pay increases. The result of that was that in a cluster of firms in the biopharma sector, an annual pay increase norm of 2% developed. And that then was spread by SIPTU and by other unions across the economy. That was the picture up to roughly maybe about 2016. Since then, things have been morphing in a direction that isn't so straightforward to explain. The 2% per annum norm has loosened considerably. Rising numbers of unions and firms have been settling above it, sometimes very considerably above it. And two things seem to be happening that is in the background to that morphing of pattern bargaining. One is that the Private Sector Committee of the Congress of Trade Unions has begun to play a more decisive coordinating role in lifting the pay targets of union negotiators and, you know, by implication then employers' expectations of what, when the chips are down, they will have to concede. And secondly, just as the economy has improved and the labour market has revived, unions and employers, I think, have in a more spontaneous way adjusted their bargaining expectations upwards. And these two things are interacting to lead to progressively rising pay increases in the period from roughly about 2016 to date.
And this year, Bill, can you give us an outline of where things are going in 2019?
So in 2019, everything is going to depend on the expectation we have about Brexit. If Britain leaves the European Union in a controlled way with an agreement, all the major macroeconomic forecasts from bodies like the Central Bank and the ESRI are benign. They talk about continuing economic growth into the medium term, 3 to 5 years. They talk about unemployment continuing to decline or full employment effectively developing with labour shortages. Against that background, I think what we can project is a continuing rise in the pay targets of unions and in employers' expectations pragmatically about what they're going to have to concede. So in a way, it's likely to be business as usual. That is the trend of recent years of more pay rises going above 2%, above 2.5%, growing numbers even exceeding 3%. That's going to continue. Should Britain crash out of the European Union without a deal, all bets are off. For sure, there will be downward pressure on pay rises, particularly in sectors like the food and agri-food sectors that are most heavily exposed to the United Kingdom. But should a disorderly Brexit happen, those sectors are not likely to be the only sectors affected. I think you will have more generalised downward pressure on pay rises and possibly, in the worst case scenario, in firms most seriously affected, a return to pay freezes or even pay cuts.
Tell me, Bill, because I think it's something that our listeners will be interested in, the difference between the companies where trade unions have recognition and the difference where companies where in companies which don't have trade unions?
So there's a huge amount of variation, particularly in the sector where unions are not recognised in pay increases. And indeed, there's variation in the sectors that, as your listeners will know, where unions are recognised and negotiate. But if we look overall at the average annual pay increases from 2011 in the non-union sector compared to the union sector, what stands out is how similar they are. All the indications we have of surveys on the pattern of annual pay rises in the non-union sector would suggest that they really are generally within a range, an average of between 2 to 3%. Not all that different to what's happening in the unionised sector.
So can we delve into that in a little bit more detail then? I mean, to ask just a bald, straightforward question, what is the role of trade unions in setting pay in Ireland?
Well, I think one of the reasons why we're seeing the unionised sector mirroring pay rises in the union sector has to do with the hard work unions have been doing in the unionised sector. You know, people might sometimes think that when non-union employers sit down to review pay with their individual staff, that they're completely blind to or they have no concern with the prevailing rate of rise in the economy as a whole in the unionised sector. But we know that is not the case. They do take account of the going rate of pay rises. They take account of the cost of living. They take account of a whole series of things. So to some extent, the fact that pay rises in the union, in the non-union sector are mirroring what's going on in the unionised sector simply reflects the fact that unions are setting the pace on an economy-wide basis in very large and important areas of the Irish economy. And non-union firms really have to take those rises into account as a benchmark when they sit down to conduct annual individual pay reviews with their employees.
Interesting points, Bill. And to draw that out a little bit further, something we were discussing just becoming before we came on air was the right to bargain, the 2015 legislation in particular. And you referenced two cases where unions had had an influence. You might draw that out again for our listeners.
Yeah, since 2015, unions in firms where employers refuse to concede recognition can pursue claims ultimately to the level of the Labour Court, where they may seek to make a case that the members they represent have fallen behind or on grounds of parity, their pay and conditions are below valid comparators, that is companies and people within companies who do the same kind of work. And there have been some claims that have gone through the right to bargain procedure that have resulted in very significant pay rises. Now, that in part reflects a long legacy of underpayment that the court has found to be a problem. I have to say, though, that one of the things that is most striking to commentators on the right to bargain procedure is how few cases have actually gone through it since 2015, partly because it's a complex procedure. It takes a long time. It's quite legalistic, quite procedural. When unions have gone to the Labour Court in those cases, they've often found the employers to be, as it were, heavily lawyered up. And so what we see is that that legislation so far less utilised than many people expected, unions pursuing rather traditional channels, deeming them to be more effective in trying to gain recognition, you know, taking cases to the Labour Court under a section of the 1969 Industrial Relations Act, which the Labour Court typically finds in favour of unions, and then, as it were, using that to claim the high moral ground in mobilising their members, but also in winning public opinion and political support for the gaining of recognition.
Bill, hold that thought because we may be coming back to it. Valentina, can I bring you in just to follow on from what Bill was saying in terms of collective bargaining? It would be fair to say, I think, that there isn't a huge debate about collective bargaining in Ireland. You might spell out for our listeners, what is collective bargaining and how do we compare in Ireland to other European countries?
So collective bargaining is a mechanism through which unions and employers set wages, and not just wages, many different types of topics can enter into the bargaining agenda of partners. And in Ireland, at the moment, collective bargaining happens mainly at the company level, exclusively at the company level, the firm level. But there are countries where negotiations still occur at national, sectoral and company level. So, and at the other end of the spectrum, you have countries where collective bargaining is still very strong. Let's say Nordic countries. One example could be Sweden, where this institution is highly coordinated and cover 80%, over 80% of employees across the economy. And then there are sort of mid-ground countries where collective bargaining is still very important, especially sector-level collective bargaining, let's say Italy. But the company is becoming increasingly more important. And as Bill was mentioning, the crisis and the, what happens after the crisis was very important in shaping the role of these institutions all across Europe. And we saw in the past 10 years a tendency, a convergence towards decentralization of collective bargaining, which means that the firm level becomes more important as a locus for negotiations.
So can you, just to draw that out a little bit, Valentina, what have been the major changes that have taken place? So there are fewer workers across Europe now covered by collective bargaining.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah. Coverage of collective agreements used to be quite stable across Europe. And so there is a before and after 2008. If it is true that coverage has been shrinking over time, the change was quite dramatic after the crisis. And today, about one third of countries have more than the majority of the employees are not covered by collective agreements. So let's say the countries with a coverage below 40% has more than doubled since 2008.
Yeah. And that, of course, has knock-on effect for workers in terms of their terms and conditions and their salaries.
Well, obviously, there have been huge effects, and it has been recognized even by very important international bodies such as the OECD, that collective bargaining has an important equal effect on equality. So it reduces the gender gap, and there is much less wage dispersion when collective bargaining is strong.
Bill, can I just bring you in on that question? Because, you know, you're a well-known commentator in Ireland on these issues, have a long history of being a leading academic in the area. When it comes to the debate around collective bargaining in Ireland, would you say it's something we talk about enough?
I think where we've talked about it mainly in recent years is surrounding the right to bargain amendments, the 2015 legislation. The big trend post 2008 was the collapse of 22 years of centralized national bargaining and the return to firm level bargaining, where Ireland, as Valentina has said, essentially comes into sync with what was happening across the rest of Europe. And prior to that, Ireland was bucking the trend in Europe. Ireland was more and more centralizing and Europe was decentralizing. Now we have also decentralized to the level of the firm. As a general rule, I think the lack of commentary on that development is a reflection of really how extraordinarily orderly collective bargaining has been since 2011 and has remained even with the extraordinary revival of the Irish economy from about 2013, the result of which is that you have had hundreds of pay deals done every year with very, very little industrial conflict, with some significant exceptions in the transport sector, the Lewis, Busairn, Irish Rail and so on. But generally speaking, everything has remained remarkably orderly. So there hasn't been a great deal of tumult or a great deal of debate around the sustainability of collective bargaining. As I mentioned, the area where there's been the greatest level of discussion is the amended right to bargain legislation. But even there, the level of activity under that is way, way lower than many people would have predicted. So no dramatic developments, say, involving disputes or public controversies or major issues leading to debate. I suppose recently most of the debate and discussion surrounding collective bargaining has been actually in the public sector rather than the private sector, specifically in the public services, where the current public service pay deal has come under very considerable pressure.
Indeed. And, you know, just to take it back for just a moment, the the legislation in 2015, which we've referenced and discussed, are there improvements needed in that area? Because, as you say, it hasn't been taken up in a massive way. And there's a debate also about the constitutionality. And again, you'd be familiar with that in the background. You know, there is a debate about what role this should have in relation to the Constitution.
Yeah, my sense of it is that for many in the trade union movement, the practical consequences of the 2015 Act have been a disappointment. The Act was intended to take things back to the pre-Ryanair Supreme Court judgment in, I think, 2008. And it was anticipated that the same or even higher levels of activity would be evident under the reform legislation, as was evident earlier. But that simply has not happened. As I mentioned, what seems to be happening is that rather than go through the pretty rigorous juridical procedure that is required under the 2015 Act, unions have actually reverted to long-established pathways to gain recognition through the Labour Court under much earlier legislation. But it has also sparked a debate within Congress that waxes and wanes a little bit about whether, in fact, to amend the Irish Constitution so as to introduce a mandatory recognition system. As your listeners will know, there is no constitutional or statutory obligation on an employer in Ireland to recognise a trade union or to negotiate with a trade union. There is a constitutional imperative to respect a person's right to be a trade union member. So there has been some debate about whether, in fact, in the light of some disappointment surrounding the 2015 Act, the trade union movement should seek political and electoral support for a constitutional amendment. That, I think, is tricky. Tricky one, because it's difficult to see how sufficient political support could be garnered to actually, you know, bring into being a constitutional recommendation. But perhaps even trickier in that if there was to be a constitutional recommendation, would a majority of people vote to change the status quo? Remember, many of those who will be voting will not be union members. They will not even be employees. They could be self-employed. They could be people who have left the labour market. They could be people who haven't even entered the labour market. So the outcome of that could be unpredictable. And so I think the debate will wax and wane and go on.
Within the law, within the existing law, you know, the Constitution notwithstanding, are there things that could be done to improve collective bargaining law in Ireland?
I think what is currently happening by unions, I don't see anybody getting up ahead of steam to go back to the 2015 Act and address its practical application so far. The volume of claims that have gone through it is restricted. Perhaps as time goes by, it will be used more frequently, though there are no indications that it will. Perhaps unions' experience of the procedure will grow. But as of now, I think what is happening mainly is that unions who are seeking recognition are putting their energies into trying to use really quite long established tactics to go to the Labour Court to get a recognition in favour of recognition, to use that as a means of bolstering the confidence of their members in companies where they're seeking recognition, to use it as a means of garnering community support, and to use it as a means of trying to win the support of local representatives. There are some really other quite interesting things happening that perhaps I think haven't got the profile that they deserve. There are a number of instances in the multinational sector where unions have managed to do really quite innovative and imaginative deals with employers where they don't formally necessarily win a formal recognition agreement, but they do in effect get the right to represent their members. CIP2 has pioneered this in manufacturing. The best known, there are one or two cases. One of them is in GE Healthcare, devices and pharmaceutical manufacturer in Cork. The other is in a Portuguese multinational called Hovione. And what happened here is the union sought recognition through a traditional means of mobilizing membership to win a formal recognition agreement. But along the way, in the face of stiff employer resistance, they decided to do something else. They concluded essentially an agreement that gave them the right to represent their members through what's called an orderly dispute resolution framework, where unions, the union can represent its members. If the parties can't arrive at a negotiated settlement, then an adjudicator, an independent third party, adjudicates on the dispute. And if either party isn't satisfied with the adjudication, then they can go to the Workplace Relations Commission and the Labour Court. Now, in practical terms, that is recognition in all but name, even though it doesn't result in a formal traditional recognition agreement. So that's another interesting innovation that is going on as unions try to grapple with this phenomenon of how to gain recognition. And even if not gaining recognition, how to gain what recognition brings you, which is the right to represent members, pursue disputes and conclude collective agreements.
It's most interesting, Bill.
I should say that the pioneer of that is Alan O'Leary in SIPTU, who has done some really quite imaginative agreements. And I know in the case of SIPTU that they would intend the GE Healthcare and the Hovione agreements to be a kind of a blueprint or a template that might be more used more widely where employers resist formal traditional recognition.
It's very, very interesting, Bill, what you say, because there is no doubt, and we can see it in the Financial Services Union, there is an increased interest in trade unions. I'm not quite sure what's driving that, but there is definitely more of an interest, I think, from workers in different sectors. I mean, we now represent workers in over 50 companies. But again, it's a challenge to achieve collective bargaining. It's a challenge to achieve that because of the law and because of the way things are set up. So we have to be innovative and imaginative about how we bring our influence to bear. Valentina, if I can come back to you for a moment. If you had a crystal ball and you were to speculate as to what the European trends are in relation to collective bargaining, what would it look like in 10 years' time vis-a-vis what the strength of workers will be at the bargaining table?
Well, Paul, this is a very difficult question to answer. It is hard to make prediction at this stage. What we know is that collective bargaining has been weakened as an institution, and we also know that...
And but does that continue, or does that reverse, or does it stay the same?
It's a matter of political will at this stage. Trade unions as well have been weakened, and we cannot expect trade unions alone to fix things. We know that industrial relation systems normally are voluntary in the sense that the state should intervene at a very minimum level in order to create the conditions for parties that independently set their terms and conditions of employment. But in reality, what we have experienced and what we have seen was an intervention towards reducing the influence, in some cases quite dramatically, like in Greece, for example, or in Eastern Europe, like in Romania. So trade unions in a hostile context, it is very hard, as you well know, to organize employees alone. They can leverage some resources. I think technologies, for example, could help hugely trade unions to try to attract new members, especially amongst the younger employees that actually need someone that represent them, because the level of insecurity they experience in the labor market is increasing massively, and they need some type of support. They're trying to do that informally, even just establishing contacts through technologies. But I think unions should take advantage of this opportunity to embrace their new demands and to do the best in this particular time.
Absolutely. And you can...
Just a comment following on from what Valentina has said. I mean, sometimes people think young people aren't interested in unions. They don't believe in trade unions. They're not supportive of trade unions. But that's actually not valid at all. International surveys looking at attitudes to unions and their role pretty well consistently show that young people are more positively disposed towards trade unions than older people. As Valentina said, thing is, they're often working in very precarious jobs and in sectors where it's very, very difficult to be represented or to seek representation, or they're anxious about that. But it has nothing to do with them being more hostile attitudinally. The reverse is the case.
It's very interesting because often, though, they'll be working in places where trade unions aren't recognised. So it's not about the place, for want of a better term. But they do, as Bill has mentioned, if asked and if approached, they can be very positive about joining unions. Valentin, it's not that you're the expert in the area of collective bargaining, but if I can just ask you, in terms of the relationship, one of the things we often debate in the trade union movement is trade union density and trade union membership. And would you agree that the attitude of the state towards trade unions is has a big influence on trade union density and trade union membership generally?
Yeah, it certainly has. It is a facilitator. Let's say it can encourage people to join a trade union. One of the dimensions that are very important in an industrial relations system is security of collective bargaining and trade union security.
Yeah.
So if you create the conditions for employers to have positive attitudes towards the trade union representation, certainly the state can have an important role in enhancing the capacity of trade unions to organising workers. If they have to organise workers in a hostile environment, it becomes much more difficult for them. And I recently joined the labour market in a way, but it is true that when you are precarious, you struggle to find someone that can help you when you need help. And often you worry whether or not joining a trade union could be detrimental for you when you join the labour market. So these type of feelings grow within a context that is probably created from the top, and the state has an important responsibility in reshaping these feelings and in giving people a higher level of security in their choices. But it is very interesting. There is a recent survey from MIT, actually. I think it's 2017, and it is available online from their website. It shows that there is a very important voice gap in not just in young generations, but in general in the United States. And obviously this linked to an increasing weakening of trade unions. And I think it is something that we should address, and the state in different forms or according to the context, because obviously every country has a different way to shape policies in a way that trade unions can play a role. But I think it is a responsibility of the country to governments to facilitate that. And there are clear indications that, as I said, even from international bodies now, it seems that trade unions and collective bargaining have become a gain something worth attention, because the weakening of this institution has increased the level of inequality, and it is something that needs to be addressed, if not for economic reasons, certainly for political reasons, because it is destabilizing in a way political the political establishment.
I think on that note, that just about sums it up for me. So Dr. Valentina Pellucci and Professor Bill Roach, thank you very, very much for joining us in the Office Block. It was a really interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, so thanks for listening as always, and thanks to everyone who assists the show, our friends in Headstuff and everybody in the Financial Services Union. Keep in touch with us. Make sure to sign up for the updates at theofficeblock.org. But until next time, I've been Paul Dillon, and thanks for listening.